That's all you. That's all you.
Thank you. My name is Kim. I'm an addict.
Hi, Kim.
How do I put this down on me? I mean, how do I put the microphone down? It's been a long time.
How's that?
Thank you. Is it right in the right place? Yeah, okay. Really. My name is Kim. I'm an addict.
Hi, Kim.
I got clean in October 11th, 1982, in New Jersey. So you may hear some MFs, Fs, and FFs, and FFs. It's the only thing that I really haven't worked on since I've been clean. But I'd like to tell you a little bit about me, because like 9 times out of 10, you may see somebody at a meeting, but you really don't know their story. You really don't know the pain or the struggle that they went through to get here and to stay here. I'm born and raised in San Francisco, California. I've lived in Wiesbaden, Germany, Albuquerque, New Mexico, Santa Fe, New Mexico. I've lived almost every state you could possibly live. Not because I had a father that was a, armed forces, because I just kept going. I was like a gypsy. I couldn't stay in one place all the time. I'm still nervous. I'm always nervous. And I know it's not an honor of, it's an honor to speak in Narcotics Anonymous. When you're asked to speak, it's an honor. And you want to do right by now. The reason I'm out of breath is because I'm going to be 69 and I had to walk up those stairs. Hold on. Thank you. Okay. Born and raised in San Francisco, California. My father was a Golden Gloves champion boxer and a fireman. My mother was a junkie. She died of an overdose of barbiturates, alcohol, and heroin at the age of 32. I'm an identical twin. My twin is deceased, and you may say, what I tell the world is that my twin was in a car accident when she was 5. The truth was, my mother murdered her. And I lived with that for a long time, but not facing it. It took me coming into Narcotics Anonymous in order to work through some steps, in order to put things down on paper in the 4-step and get real honest about where I came from and what I did and why I did it. And why I used. And there are no excuses to use. I have no fucking excuses today. I lost a husband in recovery that I was very much in love with. I did not use. I lost a child. I did not use. I've lost a best friend. I did not use. I've had car accidents. Was diagnosed with lupus. I did not use. I struggle every day with the disease of lupus. I do not use. Okay? When I got clean, I had been using, and I had been using for a long time. And here's the insanity in my disease. I don't know about yours, but I would use whatever, the dope, whatever I could get my hand on, and it wasn't working anymore. But the insanity was I kept trying to get that first high, and it wasn't coming. But I kept trying. One day, my daughter was about, I'm going to say 8, maybe 9, she's 43 now. She was out in the living room, and I walked out and I told her, I'm going into the bedroom and I want to tell you something. Put your hand here. She put her hand here. I said, you feel it beating? And she said, yes. And I said, when it stops beating, call the emergency squad. The look on her face said to me, you gotta fucking do something. You can't bring your child up the way you were brought up. You cannot do it. So it didn't hurt enough for me to stop using. You got what I'm saying? So I tried to get off. It didn't work. I tried something else. I got some better dope. I got some less dope. I got this. I got that. It didn't work. It didn't matter what I did. I could shove the pills down my throat. It didn't work. I realized at that time that I needed help. I didn't believe I was an addict so much as that I had a problem with one drug. Not telling you that I did every drug, and if something wasn't there, you told me something was good, I took it. I didn't question it. I just took it. That blind faith, you know, that we lose when we get clean. Anyway, I got to the front of the phone book, and I called the suicide line. I called other fellowships, and one fellowship said to me, honey, this isn't the fellowship for you. We have one for you that just started up. And here's the number. It's called Narcotics Anonymous.
Yeah.
So I wasn't offended at the time because I really didn't know what the fuck she meant. You know, I know now that she didn't believe that alcohol was a drug, so that was fine with me. But anyway, I called the number, and an answering machine came on. And it said, "You have reached the Narcotics Anonymous hotline. If you feel you have a problem with drugs, please leave your name and number." And I hung up. I don't know about anybody else, but I was a little paranoid toward the end. Leaving my name and number on an answering machine got me a little scared. So I called back. And I waited, and the same message, and I hung up about 3 or 4 times. Finally, I said, "Eh." The message came on. I said, "Hi, my name is Kim," which is not my real name, "and I have a friend who has a problem with drugs. Could you call me back, please?" So my real name is, I'm an addict, Yodita, Doña María Cervantes de Carvente. That's why they call me Kim. So, Snortin' Morty and Racetrack Jack called me back. See, in Jersey, everybody had a nickname. I had a nickname, too. They never told me until I had about 3 years clean. It was Kim. You know Kim. So, so I know why they didn't tell me in early recovery, because I would have, you know, I acted out a lot. There was something that Karen said that stuck with me. She said, "I never judged her. I never judge anybody." And let me tell you why. When you finish hearing me share, I have probably done about everything you could possibly do. Once you have done stuff and been judged for it, you're not likely to judge somebody else. Yes, I slept around till I had about 4.5 years. Yes, it didn't matter who, what, how, or where. You know? Yes, I lied, I stole. I did a lot of things that I did while I was on the streets in recovery for my first 5 years. But I would go into a meeting and I would share, "Oh, this program is so good and it works. You just keep working it, keep coming back." And I would hear a man over here share something and everybody just say, "Oh, he's so spiritual." So I'd go to the next meeting and repeat what he said. And for some reason, because it wasn't my experience, it didn't come out the same. And everybody just go to like, okay, you know. Anyway, I kept coming. I got the people to call me back. And as they got on the phone, they were trying to make me go to a meeting. And I say "make me" because at that time it was "make me go to a meeting." And I kept saying, "I really don't need a meeting, but I just need some help to stop using drugs." "What drug are you doing?" I said, "I only do cocaine," which was a lie. I was doing whatever I could get my hands on, and I was a dope fiend. So as we're talking, I'm trying to get off. And the guy, Morty, on the other end says, "Kim," who's still clean today, says, "Kim," I said, "Yes." He said, "Stop using." And I thought, oh my God, they know, they're here, they got cameras, I know they know I'm using. And I said, "I'm not using." He said, "Yes, you are. I can tell by the way you're talking to me." So they convinced me to go to a meeting, and I went to a meeting. I sat in the meeting, and they had a speaker, and the speaker got up to speak, and he had a suit and a tie, and his hair was cropped. And in my mind, as a newcomer, I said, "What the fuck? He ain't no addict. What the fuck is this?" And I figured they were getting somebody to come in to share about drug addiction. And I said, "Why don't they have him wear jeans or something?" So what happened was the guy got up and I started to identify with some of his feelings. But I kept pushing it on the back burner saying, "No, I'm not like him. He didn't go through what I went through. I know he didn't become what I became." So I had about enough about 15 minutes into the meeting, and I went into the bathroom. Now, I don't know how many people have gone into a church bathroom in the last stall where they have those big windows, and they have a tile ledge where you can set up. You know, churches used to be always open. Remember how old I am. And I started to set up in the woman's bathroom because I figured I got to get through this somehow. All of a sudden, I hear the door open, and I hear a man say, his name was Danny, "Kim, are you okay?" So I flushed the toilet. I started coughing and doing this. And I said, "I'm fine. I'll be out in a minute." "Okay, thank you." He said, "We're going to wait here for you." So I put all my stuff in my purse, and I came out. And I was mad. You know, very mad, yeah. Anyway, from that point forward, people showed up at my house to take me to a meeting. People showed up at my house for 2 weeks while I kicked. People would strip my house, told me that I had a choice, and I didn't believe I had a choice. I had a choice never to use again. And I thought, these people are fucking nuts. They do not know. So what happened was, I continued to come. I made 30 days clean. They gave me a little key tag. I made 60 days clean, and every time I shared, they always say, you had to raise your hand in Jersey, and they say, how does it work? And you tell them how it works. So the first 30 days, I gave a 30-minute speech on how great Narcotics Anonymous was, and they would just sit there and go, mm-hmm. At 90 days, the guy got up to say, we have a 90-day celebrant in our home group. Her name is Kim. Now, I have been through a few initials, Kim S, Kim A, Kim C. And not by choice. No, I mean, yeah, by choice. anyway, he said, this is the sickest woman that ever came into NA. Now, at 90 days, I wore that like a badge. Because I was out there, I was the sickest woman. So I was okay with that. And I walked up and said, my name is Kim, I'm an addict. And I went, blah, 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 blah. And somebody went. And I said, oh, okay, okay. At 9 months, they introduced me the same way, and I did not like it. Because at 9 months, I had started to work the steps. Now, let me share with you how I was then and how I am today. First of all, I came in here with anger and rage, did not like anybody, would fight anybody, including men. I had a fight with a man in Summit meeting during our break. I used to dress with real short skirt, no underwear, hanging out, high boots. And we had this little thing, you go from the meeting room to the kitchen and then the bathroom. And we would have to go like this. And he looked down and said something about my chest. And I grabbed his and said, who in the fuck are you to talk to me like that? I'm recovering. Yeah, you could tell I was recovering by the way I looked. Anyway, I ended up jumping on him. You know, I'm not proud of it, but it was 33 years ago, so, you know. And we fought. And people pulled me off of him, and I said, I must be at home now. You know, I'm at home. This is good. So I found out later that's how you solve your problems in Narcotics Anonymous. Anyway, I had about, I'm going to say, 18 months. I'm not sure because I don't remember month for month. But I was in a meeting, and every Friday night, everybody would go do something. They'd do this corny stuff like bowling, cards, diner, you know, something real stupid that I, you know, said, well, every weekend I would go with people. So this one night I walked around trying to find out what everybody's doing. And as I approached somebody, they got quiet. So I went over to somebody else, you know, listen, see what they're doing, and they got quiet again. And yes, not all the time when they get quiet, you don't have to be paranoid. Sometimes they are talking about you. I went to my sponsor at the time, my first sponsor, and I said, I'm trying to find out what everybody's doing, and nobody's telling me anything. She said, I know Kim. And I said, well, why not? She said, do you want me to tell you? And she stepped back. And I said, yeah, you know. And she said, well, first, you're ugly in the meetings. You dump your shit in the middle of the rooms. When you hear somebody you don't like sharing, you get up, you get coffee, you make noise, you talk to the person next to you, you puff on your cigarette and blow your smoke towards the person. We used to smoke in meetings, all meetings. And, you know, you're very disrespectful and nobody likes it. You're not getting better. So as humble as I could be at 18 months or so, which wasn't very, I said, what do I do? And she said, you work the steps. So I thought I wasn't going to have to do that, you see. I thought I was going to get by on my looks, but it didn't work that way. So I said, how are we going to do this? Now, when I came in, we had just gotten a basic text. We had a gray book is what I started my steps with. And here's how I worked them. We sat down. We read the first step out of the gray book. She shared her experience, strength, and hope. I shared my ideas, concepts, and advice. And we went back and forth. And after I finished, she said to me, "Okay, Kim." I said, "Now I finished working it. Can I move on?" She said, "No, you're not finished." She said, "What you have to do is apply it in your life. First to your addiction." I said, "That's easy. I just don't pick up." She said, "No, your addiction goes much further than just not picking up. It's your attitude. It's the way you talk, the way you walk, the way you think, the way you treat people." Really? So what I did was I did what she told me to do because I was not accepted in Narcotics Anonymous. I wasn't. I was not a nice person. So today in my life, I am extra nice to people, especially those. You ever meet somebody that just doesn't look so eye appealing, like eye candy? And everybody, nobody steps to this newcomer. Step to that fucking person that isn't as pretty as you are and carry the message, because everyone needs the message. If you do that, trust me, in your heart and soul, your spirit will rise. So I found out by working the first step and applying it in my life that I am powerless not only over my addiction, which the rest of the steps will help me with that. I am powerless over people, places, things, business meetings. Me thinking they don't know shit, you know. The man that I want that doesn't want me. The man that wants me that I don't want. I am powerless over everything. And the key to my powerlessness and to feel good about myself and to live in this world with other people is to accept my powerlessness. To accept that not everybody thinks like me. Not everybody's going to do what I think they should do. And does it happen like this now that I have 33 years? No. Situation happens, and I'm... My committee is running crazy in my head. The key is I no longer take it to everybody. I take it to my sponsor or one friend. I don't talk about the person or the thing or the situation or the group. Now I take it to one or two people and that's it. Because I need to talk about it, but I don't need to put down anything else or anybody else. I continued to stay clean, and the second step came into my life because I was in a meeting, and I was bored, and I said, "Is this all we're going to do is go to meetings, share, go to the diner?" We had diners up there. "Go play bowling, go play cards." And they said, "Maybe you have a little void in your life, maybe you need a God." And I said, "Whoa, God, higher power." I said, "I'll go with that." So my sponsor started me on the second step. And in working the second step, there were certain things that I needed, like everyone needs, to identify, to come to believe. I just didn't say, I believe. I had something to be placed in my life so that I knew there was something out there that was looking out for my best interest. So I'll share a practical thing that happened to me. I had a convertible Volkswagen Bug. No top, it was ripped, no floor. I put my foot on the middle bar and over here and then clutched, that was it. A paper clip held my engine together, and that's how I went to meetings. Well, my Volkswagen's radio did not work, and at the time I wanted a radio. So I would ask mechanics, they said, I don't know. So I was on the second step, I had just went over it with my sponsor, and in order to come to believe, I figured the arrogance of a newcomer. "Okay, God, you're there. I need my car fixed, and I need my electrical bill paid. I have a 3-month electrical bill, $123, so you just come on and get me the money to pay it." So what did I do? I didn't go out and work, I went and bought a lottery ticket. I bought the lottery ticket, went to a meeting, and ran home to watch it come up on the television. I played 744. That was by Volkswagen's license plate. I watched the balls come out as I did many times. But anyway, I watched the balls come out. And it said 7-7-4. And I said, fuck this shit. And I went to crumble it. I looked down, and the woman had punched out the wrong number. It was 7-7-4, and I won $124. My bill was $123. Now, I'm not saying go out, buy a lottery ticket, ask the higher power of your understanding to give you, pay your bills. What I'm saying is God gave me what I could identify with. He gave me a man when I asked for him. Wouldn't take him away, but he gave him to me. He allowed me to be free. When I asked him, I need freedom. Tell me what freedom is here in NA. I didn't know that I was locked in a cage the whole time I was using. And my freedom came when I was able to go and do and say anything I wanted to. I answered to no one, and the only person I answered to out in the streets was my dope. That's the only, and the cop man. That's it. So I was free, and God gave it to me. See, God gives us each what we can identify with to come to believe. It doesn't happen overnight. You may come in here and drive like my Volkswagen and get a new car. And you come into a meeting. Oh, this meeting is so good. It works. I got a new car. No, motherfucker. It ain't the program. You're not spending your money on dope. You're living a different life. And you put your money together to put a down payment to get a car. You see, the means and the ways to get more. God presents us with something. We do the legwork and it works, which takes me to the third step, which I never really liked. I only have examples of how things that stick out to me in the steps. I was in this meeting that they started that had a lot of controversy in New Jersey. I don't know if you have controversy in Virginia. I'm looking around here. I've been on the VRCC with some people, so I know. oh, God. Anyway, I was in the meeting, and I was moaning and groaning. Oh, I'm going to tell you the truth was I was PMS. I'm not anymore, thank God. But I was PMS, so I was a little bitch, you know. And when I came in, I would dump my shit, and people would just look at me and say, oh, she must be PMS, you know. Nothing came out of my mouth that was any good. And, you know, I'd always pick on one person, like maybe him, and then he'd start to share, and I go, that motherfucker, what's he sharing, you know. In my mind, not to his face. Anyway, I started complaining how I could never get a man, a healthy man. Not knowing you had to be healthy to have a healthy man. I attracted what I was. You see, we don't know that, but we attract who we are. So I'm moaning and groaning. And the last guy I went out with, blah, 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 blah. This one, blah, 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 blah. When am I going to have a healthy man? When is God going to place someone so I have a companion? I didn't mean companion. You know what I meant. But anyway, the meeting was over, and I got resentful because I don't know how they do it all the time, but up in Jersey, they give feedback and share their experience if they have some in that area, and no one had any experience to share with me. So I was pissed off when the meeting was over. I got up, and a sponsee named Margaret, she had about, I don't know, 6 years at the time, and she said, Kim. And I said, yes. And she said, God has a plan. And I went, whoa. I know. God has a plan for me, and in God's time, he's going to place a man in my life. She said, I wasn't going to say that. She says, maybe God's plan for you is not to have a man. You see, we always think that God's plan is what it should be in our minds. That somewhere down the road, we'll get that car, we'll get that family, we'll get that job. May not happen because it's not in the plan. How do we know what the plan is? Well, I got resentful and didn't speak to her for a week. And didn't like what she said. You can't tell me, I'm your sponsor. That's how I felt then. I don't feel like that now. Anyway, we started talking a couple years later. I was about, I'm going to say 48, because I don't really remember. But I joined H&I. I've been on every service commitment from World on down. You name it, I've done it. I'm not in service right now other than maybe making coffee, and that's enough for me. And I was on H&I, and I was a secretary, and the vice chair wanted to come and get the report because the chair wasn't going to be there. So I said, well, come on over. You know, I'll just print it out for you. So he came over, and I had my hair in pin curls with a scarf, black sock, holy left sock, flannel pajamas with a hole in the knees, and a ratty, ratty, old, comfortable, though, robe. I had this covered. I was a little bit recovering by then. And I started to type it up and, you know, finish it up. I looked over at him, and the first thought that came to my mind was, man, he's a good-looking man. Usually what comes to my mind is, oh, my God, I got to get that. Would you like me to lie? So all of a sudden, because I thought he was good looking, and I thought he was nice looking, and he was a nice guy, I started to get self-conscious by the way I looked. I didn't have makeup on. My hair wasn't done. I wasn't dressed nice. But then I thought, well, if he likes me like this, he must really like me, you know, if he likes me. So I just leave that on the back burner for a minute. My trials and tribulations with men had been many. For instance, I realized after I did my four step that I attract the same type of man over and over. For instance, they're emotionally unavailable, not anymore, but physically unavailable. What do you mean physically unavailable? Well, married. And because I've changed, you know, married men are out of the picture. So I went to in this gym in Paterson, New Jersey. Has anybody ever heard of Paterson? Yeah. Hallelujah. My husband was from there, but we're talking before the meeting, and my friend Clyde, I just went to his 30th anniversary up in Jersey. I saw this man standing over by the coffee pot with dark hair, blue eyes, and he's smoking a cigar, which turned me off, but that doesn't matter. And he had orderly greens on and a pair of jeans, and I went, whoa. So I looked at Clyde, and I said, what's his name? And he started laughing. I said, what are you laughing for? And I said, I know, he's married. She said, no, he's not married, Kim. I said, he's gay. No. I said, the only thing left is that he's a newcomer. He said, no, it's his parish, Kim. Even at a meeting, if you're not Catholic, you won't get it. Catholic priests don't dress like Catholic priests up in Jersey. They don't dare. Anyway, even in a church, I'm attracted to the most unavailable man. Go figure, you know. So after doing a couple of four steps just on specifically relationships and men, I found out what my problem was, not their problem. I found out what I do and what I attract is who I am and what I do and what I say. I love you, go away. That's my famous, I love you, go away. Now, I don't say that, but I act that. Can't wait to be with you. You're right here. Oh, God. Call me. Oh, yeah, I can't talk right now. You got what I'm saying? Even though I want to, I don't know. It's a sickness that I just can't explain. Anyway, my life has a lot of gratitude in it. First, I've grown up. I may be 68, but I'm really 39. You know, I was really young when I came in. I was in high school. You know. If I liked a guy, I couldn't talk to him. Anyway, being in your 30s, not being able to talk to a man. Anybody identify? Yeah. Ugh. Those normal people don't. Earth people don't get it. They just see somebody talk, and all of a sudden they're in a relationship. They get married. They have kids. They go to work. You know, they make money the right way. Hello. You know, they have a drink, a drug, and then say, I don't want any more. My daughter's father was like that. When he found out I was in recovery, and I mean, he's in his 70s now, because, you know, I'm an old broad. I told him I'm in recovery. I had about a year, and my daughter was there. She was meeting him for the first time, believe it or not. And he said, what do you mean you're in recovery? I said, well, I go to a 12-step fellowship, and I don't use drugs. Nothing? He said, what did you use? And I told him. He said, shit, I use cocaine, and all I did is put it down. It was too expensive. And I said, well, fuck you, honey. You know, I don't know. Some people can do it and some people can't. And I wish I had the answer. I don't have the answer. I just know that if I continue to be good to people, if I treat people like I want to be treated, if I apply the steps in every area of my life most of the time, I will get some just rewards. And I will live a life that is happy. And I am happy. I've got shit going on in my life now. But because of my gratitude and because of what I do, I'm okay. I'm not going to use. I'm not going to go out and hibernate. You know what I mean? Not going to go out and spend a lot of money on clothes that I don't need. When I did my four step, I was a little confused. I thought that when you did your four step, all of a sudden you got really good. You became NA member. I'm an NA member. I did my four step. And I wanted to share it with everybody. And my sponsor now, who I've had for the last 29 years, said, you do not share your four step in a meeting until you do your fifth step. Do not share what you have to say in a meeting. I mean, I'd go in and say what I did. I didn't give a shit. And I'd probably say it now, and I probably will. I did whatever I could. Now, during my fourth, fifth, and sixth step, I had an experience that told me that my lust was no longer acceptable in my life. How could lust not be acceptable in my life? It feels good. And God is in the mix. Oh, God, you know? He's in the mix. So, how did I work this? I went from man to man, and I don't mean every day. You know, I went from man to man. They lasted sometimes 6 weeks to 6 months. That was a long relationship. Anyway, I was in a meeting, always in a meeting, and it was in an auditorium in Montclair. You know how the seats go up, and then you're sitting down here with the chairperson to speak? Guy walks in. He didn't know, but I knew he was going to be mine by the end of the meeting. As he walked down, I smiled. Didn't know anybody else was in the room. Didn't care. And then they announced me to speak on a step. Do you know it is the only time in my recovery that I practically quoted the basic text and sounded so spiritual? If you didn't know me, you'd say, oh my God, isn't she spiritual? You know, the things we do to get what we want. If he likes football and I hate football, I'd learn about football. If he liked a certain meal, I'd make it, even if I didn't know how. I was a chameleon when it came to men. To get what I want, I became what you wanted. Well, this guy, after the meeting, came up to me, and he said, I really liked what you shared. And what I heard was, because I was still in fantasy, you're a fine woman, I'm going to make you mine. So I immediately asked him out for coffee. And I said, you want to go for coffee? And he said, sure. So we went to the local diner for the meeting. We sat down, we ordered coffee, we started talking. And he started telling me some things he thought about me. I had such low self-esteem. When he said, you're pretty, I thought he said I was beautiful. He started saying things that helped my inflated ego get big. He started saying things because I didn't know how to be self-confident, that he was building up my confidence. Nobody does that today. I do my own building. So we're sitting and we're talking, and he says, oh, Kim, Kim, Kim. And I said, He's still around. I don't want to say his name. We're friends now. He's married. A lot of kids, you know. Thank God I didn't marry him. Anyway, one was enough. Anyway, well, two, but one, you know. So as he's finished telling me, as he's talking to me, I'm hearing my sponsor give a new... Oh, no, he said to me, how much time do you have? And I said, 4 years. He went, oh, my God. You know what I thought? Whoa. I got this motherfucker. He thinks I got time. So I said, well, how much time do you have? And he said, 30 days. My sponsor's words went in my mind. Give a newcomer a foundation. Allow him to get a foundation. Let them alone. If it's meant to be, it'll be. And let it free. It'll come back. All that crap. So I said, look, I'm attracted to you. But if you stay clean for a year and we still feel the same way, no problem. So he looked at me and he rolled his eyes pitifully. And he looked down and he licked his lips and he looked up at me and started saying some more stuff. And I told him 6 months was fine. Now, there is some humor in that because it didn't last 6 hours. But I want to share with you that there is also pain in that humor. And you are unmercifully judged by addicts when they find out. I went into a meeting. It was a candlelight meeting. You have candlelight meetings around here? You think that nobody can hear you or something because it's dark? I don't know. People share more honestly or something because it's, you know, real dark. And they say, I can share this. Nobody will know who I am. So I go in. I'm a little late. I sit down to my friend Youssef, who came in the same time I did. And I said, what's the topic, Youssef? I thought it was relationships. He said, you, Kim. The newcomer had shared the exact nature why he believed he went out and shot dope. Yes, if I want to use, I choose to use. But I contributed to that newcomer picking up. And if you think you don't contribute when you go to a newcomer or anybody that's fallen short in an area that needs some help, think twice. For your own personal satisfaction, you have helped that person use. You didn't stick the spike or the pill or the smoke or whatever you did, but you helped. You contributed. So the lights went up. I didn't share at that meeting, by the way. Didn't think it was a good idea. The lights went up, and I saw people looking at me like this. Can you see my face? And I'm saying, what the fuck is wrong with everybody? A sponsee came up to me and said, I'm getting a new sponsor, Kim. You're a sick motherfucker. Now, I was working on anger, so I said, well, that's your opinion, you know, and I wanted to go, but I didn't. Then somebody else came up to me and told me what they thought. Then somebody else pulled me aside and told me what they thought. And then one person came up to me and said, you know, Kim, I always thought that you walked on water. I am so glad that you fell short. I am so glad that you're a human being, and it's so nice to know that I, too, when I get some time, 4 years, will fall short and know what it's like. Maybe I can learn from this. Another guy said, you're not sick, Kim. In this area, you're very sick. But you do other things in recovery. You're in service work. And I was in service work for 25 years, back to back. And every service commitment you could do, you give it away. When you're asked to share, you share. They say, come set up the meeting. You set up the meeting. Get involved with this. You get involved with that. Get on the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon when you want to go meet somebody. You do your share, but in this area, you need some work. So I left the meeting, and that's when I had hit a bottom in that area. Like all the steps, they fall into place right on time. After doing my fifth step and finding out that we're not all so that different. We do all the same stuff. I remember when I did my fifth step, I did it with this girl named Peggy, who's now deceased, and I took her in a paddle boat out in the middle of a lake because I didn't want anybody to hear me. I still had a little fear that someone was listening. And I told her the most vile thing I had ever done because I wanted to get that off of my chest. I'd never shared it in my life. I'll share it with you because that's it's done. And I have amended the situation again and again and again by certain actions I have taken. I lived in the Tenderloin section of San Francisco, which is comparable to 42nd Street in New York or Fillmore in San Francisco. And I lived in a $2 a night hotel. And yes, that's where we started our drug using at 12 years old. And a guy came in to get a hit from the guy that I was seeing and trying to do something to me. You know what I'm talking about. And I was lying about my age, even though I'm sure they knew. And I threw lie in his face. By throwing lie in his face, because in that day and age, that was our defense. It wasn't knives and guns and all that shit. It was lie. You carried a bottle of lie around. And to this day, he doesn't see. So when I shared that with her, I waited for her to go, or to scrunch her face, or to look at me in judgmental. And she didn't budge. What she said was, and she started to share her most, to her, vile thing she had ever done. The sickest thing that she had ever done, which I won't share with you. And in my mind, I said, shit, I'd do that today. That's not so bad. We are as sick as our own secrets. We hold ourselves hostage. Because what she did, I'd do today. I'd probably do it today. Maybe. I don't know. Probably not. Okay. I had to think that through. But the sixth step is what taught me, and I'm only going to go that far because I looked at the time. The sixth step was my favorite step. Why? Because I was able to make the drastic change I needed to continue to stay in Narcotics Anonymous. In the sixth step, I experienced all of my character defects. The lust I told you about. I didn't tell you about the gossip, but I will. The talking about people. The untrue gossip. Not just the gossip like so-and-so's going out with so-and-so and he's an asshole. You know, not that type of stuff. I remember when I got to the ninth step and I told my sponsor I'd been gossiping about this girl who used to call me Kimmy. I used to hate the name Kimmy. And I told her, you know, I've been telling people things about her that ain't true. And she said, well, give me an example. And I said, well, I told her a lie about somebody and waited for it to come back to me. So when they came back to me, I could say, I didn't tell her that. I was a sick motherfucker. So I said, she said, well, what do you think you're going to do? I said, well, I'm going to pull her aside and I'm going to amend the situation. She said, no, you're not. By you telling her what you said and did to her and apologizing is going to bring it to her forefront if she doesn't know. What you're going to do is go to the people that you lied about her to and tell them you were lying. If you do that when you get to your ninth step, I guarantee you will not be talking or hurting anybody anymore. It's real tough to go to somebody and say, look, remember I told you about so-and-so? It wasn't true. First, the people go, because they can't believe you're in recovery and you did that? Ooh. Anyway, my sixth step was favorite because I experienced all my range of feelings. And I found out that for every action, there is a reaction. Now, that is also part of... And this has nothing to do with narcotics. Some people are Baptist, some people are Christian, some people are Jewish. I go to a Buddhist center. Everything I do comes back to me somewhere, somehow, not the same exact thing, but there is always a reaction. So what I have learned through Narcotics Anonymous in the steps is to live a life that I would want to live for the rest of my life if it were placed in front of me to me, which means... Got a friend called me. He's he manages metal bands. Now I'm not into metal music, so I can't name them. But metal bands, and he looks like that. He's in recovery. You know, he's got ears and tattoos, and he's big. And, motherfuck you! But he's clean for a long time, you know. And he called me the other day, and he said, "I'm back in the area. I really need help." And I said, "Sure." He said, "I got a sponsor. I'm clean for 2 years now again. But my sister is now getting clean." His sister is one of those people that I bet if she sat over there, no one would go talk to her. Because not only is she not attractive, she doesn't smell good. She doesn't talk like we talk. She can't carry on that conversation like you and I can talk when we're talking back and forth. So that's the one that I said, I will call her. She's called me twice. I returned the call, told her I was out here, that I would call her when I got home. See, everybody deserves Narcotics Anonymous. Everyone. Black, white, green, orange, Asian. My dog deserves Narcotics Anonymous. I'm just saying that because I love animals. But there's some things that we all... And I'm one that never tells people what to do and all that shit. But I can tell you that if you don't follow certain suggestions in Narcotics Anonymous, you're not only doomed to repeat certain things and maybe go out, but you will live a miserable fucking life. And I have seen it in my recovery. I have been through it in my recovery. I have gone through periods of time where I said, fuck this, I'll just go to meetings, pay a visit, and go home and do what I have to do. And turned out with an attitude that you would say, what the fuck is wrong with Kim? Is she using? And been miserable behind, didn't like people that did nothing to me. Somebody would share in a meeting and I would go, what the fuck are they talking about? They shared about that the other day. Maybe they needed to share it again. So what I do for myself in recovery is a couple of things. I have a sponsor and I use her. Her name is Leslie. I love her. And I want to be like her when I grow up, and I'm older than her. I make meetings on a regular basis. Now I'm switching home groups. So I'm looking for a new home group, and I sort of have it Thursday afternoon in Roanoke, Virginia. Real good meeting. I've been there a couple of times, if not more than a couple of times, and I like it. When anybody walks in the door, they greet everybody, even people that have been around for a while. Like, they know me, but they say, hey, Kim, hi, how are you? I like that. I like to not be recognized, but to be welcomed into the room. I hate going into a meeting and everybody knows you. I go, yeah, hi. You got time. You'll be okay. No. I'm not always okay. I got problems. I got stuff that goes on. And it's usually the newcomer, when I say newcomer, anybody less than 33 years that has something to give to me. Any experience that'll help me. I'm not prejudiced. Give it to me. I don't care how you give it to me. If you swear, fine. If you want to put a little religious tack on it, don't. I know, I'm so honest, I'm so brash. Yeah. I live in Roanoke, Virginia. You know, I'm from San Francisco, lived all over. When I first moved down here, I knew some people from where my husband and I lived here together before he passed. And did I tell you he passed? Yeah. I'll share this and I'm gonna stop because it's gonna get me friggin' emotional. February 8th, he celebrated some time. I think it was about 10 years, something like that, 1998. February 23rd, he dropped dead. He was 45 years old. We had just gotten married 18 months. He was a good man, meaning he never said a word about anybody. I would. Everybody liked him. When I first met him, I remember asking people about him because I have such a poor choice in men. Of course, I change now, so. And they say, oh, he's such a nice guy. I like him. He's this, he's involved in this, and da 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 da. I said, something's wrong with him if he's that nice, you know. And he started, you know, he wouldn't ask me out, so I asked him out. I forgot to tell you that part earlier. I did everything but do what I did when I was new. Knew I would go like, hey, hi. And now it's sort of like, here's what you get and this is it, you know. And we went out and he dropped me off and I asked him up for coffee. And he said, no, thank you, Kim. And he gave me a hug, kissed me on the cheek and drove off. So the next time he took me for dinner, I said, you want to come up for coffee? He said, no, Kim, thank you. Kiss, hug. The third time he did it, guess what I thought? Something's wrong with me. Not him, me. What's wrong with me? So I took it to all my women friends. I had a little women's wrap at my house, and that was the topic. Kim and her love worries. And all the women were saying to me, it's his loss. They don't know what they're missing. He doesn't know what he's missing. If he doesn't want, you know. But I went to one of my best friends, Jerome, who now may he rest in peace. And I said, Jerome, and I told him the story, that he just won't do anything, make a move. And it's been, like, this time it was 3 months. And he looked at me and he said, do you think maybe he respects you? Whoa. Respect? I got respect? I never had fucking respect. And I looked at it in a different perspective, so I had to make a different plan. So we... I know, a little manipulation never hurt. So we had an H&I, the church had a cancellation, so we had it at his house, and he put a spread out, and we did the H&I meeting, and everybody left, and I sat on the couch. And he said, "You want me to walk you to your car?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, you know," he lived in, near the Alabama Projects, which is, when you step outside, you're on crack files. Now, crack wasn't out when I got clean, but I know what it looks like, you know. I said, "Here's my keys. I got an overnight bag in the back seat. You can go get it. I'm not going home." And he starts laughing. And he got my bag, he came upstairs, and he said, "I want to tell you something." And I said, "Oh boy, he's gay." And, and he said, "I'm going to tell you why I don't sleep around with women in Narcotics Anonymous." And all of a sudden, I felt this little bit of shame. Well, I sleep around with men, you know. But he knew that because he had heard me share, and he sort of knew me from the rooms. And I think I had about 12 or 13 years at the time. I can't remember what I had about that. I was a little healthier, you know. I'd stopped screwing around and stuff. And now it's been forever. But anyway, I almost forgot. No, I'm just kidding. You never forget. But and women, when you get menopausal, don't let them tell you that shit. It goes away. It don't go away. It gets better. But anyway, he said, "The reason I don't sleep around with women in the rooms is when I go into a meeting, I go in for my recovery. I don't want to have to look over here and see a woman I fucked. I don't want to look over here and see another woman I slept with. And I can't concentrate on what I need to do for me to stay clean." I never heard that before. Usually it's, "Yeah, okay, let's go." So I respected that. And of course, that night was it, by the way, let me just tell you. And I'm not going to go into detail, but it was nice. I said yes when he asked me to marry him. How's that? But anyway, he did ask me to marry him. And we, you know, you get clean, you save money. 401k, it's your business, you know, you save money. You can buy a house. We bought a big house down in Blue Ridge, Virginia, which is near Roanoke. He started part of his business down here and went well. I worked a little for him delivering stuff, you know, to do something. Then I went into a law firm that I do usually. And that's when my friend called me and said, "It's John." I said, "Oh, John isn't home yet. He'll be home soon." Because he would come home and the employees would call if something went wrong with the equipment or something. And he said, "No, it's John." He said, "He passed out." And I said, "Is he breathing?" And they said, "Yes." So I panicked. I ran outside. And for some reason, as God would have it, or higher power would have it, my neighbor was standing by her van. And I couldn't drive. I had a stick at the time, so I really couldn't drive. And I asked her, "Could you take me to Carilion? My husband's in the hospital." She took me to Carilion. On the way, I called every member of Narcotics Anonymous I knew. It's 8 o'clock at night. Where do you think they're at? So I left voicemails. I get there. I'm running around frantic. They put me in a room with three couches, boxes and boxes of tissues, and two telephones. The doctor comes in, and I said, "I need to see my husband. Is he okay?" And they asked me, "Did he have a bad heart?" "Does he have a bad heart?" I said, "No, he doesn't. He doesn't even smoke. He never smoked in his life. He doesn't drink. And, you know, let me go see him and then we'll do all the history." They put their head down, just like in the movies. "He's passed, Miss Agnew." Immediately, I was angry. I was angry at the God of my understanding who brought me this far, put a man in my life that was good, was going the same direction, was liked by everyone, and was an honest man with real integrity. I felt safe emotionally with him. I could be a bitch and it was okay. When they finished telling me, I got up and I opened the door because they were going to take me to see my husband. And members from Narcotics Anonymous from Lynchburg, Bedford, and Roanoke were outside for me. They were there to help me. If it wasn't for the members of Narcotics Anonymous, I would have went out and shot fucking dope. I don't know how strong I would have been. They carried me. They carried me to my house. They picked out his clothes. They took me to the funeral parlor. They called 50-something people in Jersey. They came down and they opened up their homes to people from Jersey. That's saying something. We're not as bad as you think. So when I went back to Jersey and it was time for me to retire, I chose to come back to Roanoke. I chose to come back down to Virginia because of the warmth and the love that I've received. Right now, in the past month, I don't feel connected. And I've been speaking a lot, going out of state and stuff. It is not that. I just don't feel connected because I'm raised a certain way in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't believe in taking drugs to stay clean. I'm not into Suboxone. I did methadone. I kicked for methadone. They wouldn't fucking let me talk until I was off methadone. I'm just not connected emotionally or physically. Doesn't mean I'm going to stop coming, though. I'm not. I have my network. I have people in my life. I'm not alone. Narcotics Anonymous has given me too much. It gave me a man like no other man. I mean, yeah, I tried dating 3-4 years after he died. I compare everybody to him. So somewhere around 65 years old, I said, if there's going to be someone, God will place him in my life like he placed John in my life. And if not, guess what? Maybe I won't have someone. But I'm okay. Have you ever been okay with something? You just know it's okay? Anyway, when I got clean, there was a blackboard and a guy named Billy G who passed away a month after I got clean. And everybody loved this man. And he wrote this on this blackboard and it stayed in my mind. At the time, I didn't understand it, but I understand it today. It said, Narcotics Anonymous did not open the gates of heaven. It closed the gates of hell. Thanks for letting me share.
That was awesome. And give our speaker another round of applause. Yeah. Yeah. Fucking A, dude.